You were asking us to introduce, well, to let us tell about our project.
Yeah,
well,
yeah,
stuff we are doing. Yeah. I propose you start just telling about a little history of Kuski.
I did get a little bit of it from him last night.
Right. Well, I think about the program. Yeah. 10, 11 years ago.
When was it exactly? 99?
Yeah, something like that. Yeah. So almost 12 years ago.
Yeah. That's, geez, you
feel old.
we started pretty much the first internet cafe in Utrecht in a squad, completely run on recycled hardware. We're using open source software and giving away free internet to the masses. At that point, that was a very new, innovative thing. Like I said, we were the first internet cafe in Utrecht.
Second in Netherlands, more or less.
Yeah. Yeah, there was maybe a few already in Amsterdam, but
yeah,
it was all very new and exciting. And yeah, and she ran on a noisy 28K8 modem and crusty bits of hardware stuck together. And that grew out to be very successful. Mm-hmm. Around 2002, 2003, we were open 7 days a week. There was about 40 volunteers or something that kept the place running. Then over the years, as everyone had broadband internet access at their homes, even at their squats, I mean, the whole project didn't make much sense anymore. We had occasional workshops which were interesting enough, but didn't really, there was no more need for an open internet cafe as we had it back then, and we put our focus instead on maintaining our own server, doing all kinds of hosting for mostly local groups and individuals that we support and have affinity with. And in the meantime, yeah, we're a bunch of friends really who like to do techie stuff and go to events and make radio and do other crazy stuff. Get wireless internet in trees and whatever.
The internet should be everywhere.
Even tree huggers. And you actually devote some time to doing internet for events like this, or?
Yeah.
Well, not just this event, but whenever there is something, you know, whenever there is an event or a talk or some artist stuff or whatever, or some political stuff, mostly the people in Netherlands know where to find us and they ask us to set up the infrastructure needed. And like a couple of weeks ago, or actually in March, for instance, Noam Chomsky went to the Netherlands and he gave a lecture in Amsterdam. We were asked by the organization as well to registration, video registration of this lecture. And we streamed it live as well, completely using our own resources.
If you don't mind me digging into the techie details a little bit, can you tell me a little bit about how much resources that consume in terms of measurable bandwidth? Do you have numbers like for that? I guess what's the Icecast for video?
Yeah, of course, we use Icecast for video. For a local line, you don't need much, of course. I mean, you can do basic DSL line, is good enough to send your video to an Icecast server. In this case, we used the GISTV network.
Yeah,
which is a network of Icecast servers, a lot of different nodes all throughout the world, which relate to each other. So in theory, this network can reach up to 10 or 20,000 viewers without any problem. I don't know how many nodes there are in the network at this moment, but it could be over 100. So.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. That this nice program that rendered a map of the world with all the different nodes, and it was one huge spider web.
And did you get a count of how many people watched this?
Yeah, we did. There weren't that many viewers, actually.
Well, the interesting thing was the event sold out within a day, I think. It was really fast. Mm-hmm. And then there was organized public screenings at two other places, like one in Utrecht and one in Nijmegen. And they both had like 20-30 people attending or something. Yes. I'm not sure about Nijmegen actually.
Nijmegen, the public viewing in Nijmegen was in the library. Mm-hmm. Actually, no, it was not in the library, it was in cinema in Nijmegen. Yeah. And there were 30 or 40 people attending there.
Yeah. It's interesting that we live in this era where basically there's so much media that almost the. We're essentially chasing consumers of media on some level in this very strange way, especially for live streaming sort of events. It's like, you know, Noam Chomsky, if you go to YouTube and search for Noam Chomsky, you can watch hours and hours of him talking about his, you know, shoelaces. And I guess around 12 years ago, a number of us started a tech collective called Angry Nerds, and so we basically started with a server already at that time in the U.S. Broadband was pretty common, and so we started with a server and a cabinet and really hacked our way for the first couple years, just hacked our way through what it takes to break a server and embarrass yourself in a variety of ways. And, yes, I don't talk about those embarrassing stories anymore, you know. But over time, the collective faded away. I was the only sysadmin. Everyone else were programmer types, and they were, of course, more useful when it came to making money, to the extent to which we were trying to find freelance jobs. But obviously, I was more useful in terms of running the server.
Yeah.
And so nowadays we have only me as far as on the tech side. We have another half dozen people who do a variety of like running particular websites and all the rest. But over time, our responsibilities have grown. In many ways, we're an anarchist specific rise up. Mm-hmm. So we host a couple hundred anarchist websites from around North America, and the email addresses and all the rest for all of them, and
like Ryza, do you also raise your own money? Or?
Well, to be honest, because I'm one of the few anarchists in North America with a career. up till now, most of it's easily been affordable through my own pocket. Mm-hmm. And because most of the time I work in data centers, of course, resources can be leveraged and probably beyond the capacities of most people. And what's interesting is to think about, like, in terms of the future and how to organize leveraging affordability versus flexibility and all the rest is I'm really thinking a lot about what it looks like moving forward on how to... In my particular case, I'm thinking a lot about what it looks like when someone takes down a particular server. You know, what does it look like to rely on cloud computing in certain contexts? And so currently we're two servers, both in geographically different locations. We're going to do a third by the end of the summer, either in Europe or on the East Coast of the U.S. I'm actually, part of the reason I'm here is to learn from techie people about the laws associated with running servers, and
going down the hill.
The EU sounds frightening. There's actually a good chance that I may have some server space in one of the protected servers in Greece.
It's one of the few nice remaining parts.
They're pretty amazing, and of course they're. I mean. Technically, they're not that sophisticated. They're probably 8 years behind where you all are. They're making all their mistakes now. Like, oops, deleted directory. They're telling me the story of deleting the Etsy directory just a few months ago. So, so mostly in terms of my project, I run a lot of. Sites and the most high profile of them being anarchistnews.org, which pushes 3-4 megs most of the time actually, which is pretty amazing given that it's just images and text. So,
mm-hmm.
yeah.
Alright.
Well, just pretend there's no microphone. So we are. I'm just telling you, you're here to learn about the you know, the law and all that, and about the juridical barriers that might be existing in Europe as well as in Netherlands as well, I suppose.
The problem is the EU is one body, and the only real question is to what extent are there differences? Mm-hmm. Like others have told me that, like, one of the things I'm considering is setting up an EU.anarchistnews.org. Mm-hmm. And people have said to me, if you set that up in the Netherlands, that will be very bad news, like it won't last long at all.
I severely doubt that, actually. Mm. It's also it's not true. I mean, okay, there's this European hierarchy here, but it's not really like a federal state like in the United States. So every country does have their own laws, and every country is kind of different. Regarding laws, such as, for instance, France and Germany have laws which are, in one respect, much further repressive than here in the Netherlands at this moment. So,
yeah, I heard that you just your legislature just agreed to a net neutrality configuration of some sort.
Sort of balloon.
That's a bit of a hollow promise. It's mostly about the commercial. Leveraging on cell phone data traffic.
Oh, so this is a response to the Google thing more than even
more like that
than reality.
Yeah, it's the title sounds nice.
Basically, law proposals get accepted in Parliament almost on a weekly basis with no fundamental knowledge about the actual technology whatsoever. There's now a proposal going to enforce. Consumer choice in the use of cookies. You, as a website, mandatory have to ask your customer whether or not to accept this cookie, which is not really how things work.
Yeah. It will change everything.
CMS writers, back to the keyboards.
So.
I'm not really convinced that an anarchist news.eu would not have no chance at all here in the Netherlands. We've also been involved in the Unimedia collective in the Netherlands here. We've been existing now for over 10 years. Of course, we have our slight problems with the system. But so far, we've never been taken down at all.
Came close once.
Came close once, yeah.
Which what was it about?
It was a weird case, right? 8 years ago, something like that. There was an article posted in the Netherlands, which had a URL in it, a hyperlink to another website. On this website, there was a link again to a manual on how to sabotage the German rail system.
It wasn't even about sabotage. It was pretty fluffy. Like, how do you make a lock on to
a train? It was about how do you make balls, metal balls. How do you throw them over the electric powering block?
That's suicidal.
It was about a magazine, a German magazine called. Name actually.
Was this recent or
2002, 2003, something like that?
Somewhat prescient, huh? We actually had a very similar posting about 3 months ago. That was my understanding is that in the U.S. these are the sorts of things nobody cares about, like the how-tos and the whatnot. They'll prosecute someone for it if they want to do that anyways. But I mean, if to chase down those sort of
hypothetical,
it's like, you know, that would put an end to, you know, stopping bank robberies, you know. it was very strange to see. It seems like several different sources have been talking about trains in particular. Maybe it's since Tarnak or something, and then all of a sudden, what was it last month? Mm-hmm. This crazy thing happened that shut down half of Berlin, right?
Mm-hmm. Tell us more.
Mm-hmm. You don't know about this.
No.
Some sabotage happened just a few weeks ago.
Yeah.
That essentially stopped the rail, the commuter rail traffic, for hundreds of thousands of people.
Okay.
And so basically, for hundreds of thousands of people affected for like 4 to 6 hours. I'll pull up the URL for you.
Well, yes. this I remember the name of this German magazine again. It was called Radikal, which was a political magazine from Germany, on paper, mostly. It was sort of radical, direct action magazine.
Sure.
Yeah, and these actions against the railway system were all about the involvement of the German rail system in the transport of nuclear transport.
Ah, yeah.
So that's nuclear waste transport. Yeah.
So someone has a problem with this post on Indie Media. How did the process go?
The process was a very technical process actually, because it was just a referral to a hyperlink.
Yeah.
There was no question about the fact whether this actual content was, or the actual magazine was prohibited or not. It wasn't even an issue. So it was...
Was webmaster at Indie Media sent an email saying, please remove this link?
Initially, yes. And then we as collective said, well, fuck you. I mean, we're not hosting this article at all. We just place a link to an article which discusses this magazine, which has a link to the magazine itself. So it was, link on link on link. We really were convinced that and anyway, this court case just deranged in a technical bullshit story about whether putting up a link was actually the same as hosting or not.
Ah.
And then the judge decided that putting up a link is actually, yes, it's the same as hosting the material.
Oh, which really?
Is real weird, and which way for real weird.
Google should be banned.
I would think the lawyers would have gone crazy to fight for that against that.
Well, it was an isolated case, and a case like this never happened again. Almost everybody forgot about it, so we got fined for a couple of €100, I think.
Oh, you did?
We paid up, and that was it, I think.
Interesting.
So, we should have gone into appeal, I think, but...
There's a financial issue to that as well, because going into appeal was
much more.
Shitload of money.
Yeah.
Interesting. You see, in the US, the EFF would have loved that case.
Yeah.
They would have loved that case, Right now, I also live about 4 blocks from the Long Haul, and I'm somewhat involved with it, mostly as a user, but... So the Long Haul is an info shop based in Berkeley, California, and... About 3 years ago, there were a couple direct actions that happened around the UC, the University of California higher education system, including some threats against vivisectors.
Mm-hmm.
So it was all in the animal rights space. And one of the emails was sent from the Long Haul.
Mm-hmm.
And the federal agencies and the UC police officers raided the Long Haul and removed all the computers to essentially find what they can find about this person who sent these emails and all the rest.
Yeah.
And of course, my intervention was that afterwards, I was strongly trying to compel the entire place to take a much more to take a stronger stance against this sort of thing happening in the future. In other words, removing the hard drives from the end user machines and all the rest. And but at the end, I totally lost the fight. And the convenience or death crowd won, but anyways, we're right in the middle of a lawsuit with the EFF leading the charge against the federal government for seizing the machines. They've yet to be returned, as a matter of fact. But I mean, they're all pieces of junk donated machines, so it's not a big deal. But yeah, kind of an interesting case. I had Anarchist News. I received my first knock on the door from the police just about 6 months ago, and it started out as an international investigation from Canada.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, the G20 happened in July, and
anarchist news. Some people who were in the Toronto area, they had uncovered two snitches, two federal agents in their midst, and they essentially wrote these dossiers about them, mm-hmm. and submitted them to kind of every site who would care in North America. And 6 months later, the agencies involved in the G20 protests got to me and essentially asked me to take it down. But what's amazing is just to think about the costs for things like this. Like, they filed a warrant to find out who I was behind my blocked who is. They filed some sort of a I guess they just filed, like, they paid whatever fee it took to ask a U.S. agency to come to my door. And then they said, threatened to get my logs from me. But of course, I hold no logs, so there's nothing for them to grab. And that was it. Yeah. So it was very interesting to just imagine the tens of thousands of dollars that were spent. But it, yeah.
So you got takedown notice for this, and you didn't respond to the takedown notice, or they just shoot you immediately? Or they pressed you for...
They wanted me to take down the information about the police officers, is at the heart of it.
Yeah.
And in a situation like this, because of the cost, because of obviously, like, both the questions of, like, whether or not I was even in a safe space,
mm-hmm.
I was willing to just take it down and because it avoided the whole conflict.
Mm-hmm.
Also, I'm not sure from the perspective of being one person rather than more of a collective project, how responsible or useful it is for me to kind of go to war with states. In the case of G20, the OPP, the Ontario Providence Police Department, they got nearly $1 billion to defend them to defend themselves against the protesters. But they had a lot of money they had to spend, and so I just wasn't quite sure I was prepared for that.
In this case, this information is spread anywhere to absolutely the people who yeah. need to have this information. So.
No, absolutely. I mean, yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
I mean, all the people who were part of there's this crazy thing there where they have, like, 12 people who are under house arrest or some variant of house arrest, all of whom aren't allowed to talk to each other.
Mm-hmm.
Some of whom, of course, have never met. But some of these people include siblings. So, like, the siblings can only meet with their parents or supervising. It's all these very strange sorts of Canadian-specific laws, in effect. Anyways, I talked to some of them, and they said, you know, we've had these printouts. We've known this information for, you know, we're the ones who put it up. I mean, so it was very, very strange. And a classic of, like, kind of the way in which the states think. Right?
Yeah, that's funny. I think recent events within the media and getting requests for takedown, the most effective strategy was to create as much drama around it as possible as you can.
Yeah.
There was one occasion where there was a picture of a Nazi beating someone up who contacted to take the picture down. And, well, the next day the picture was all over the internet.
Oh, interesting.
The request for takedown was...
never followed up.
No.
Yes, ED. Yeah, but... And also the whole thing where logs, usually that ends anyway with the whole, like, logs? We don't have any logs.
Yeah, you're not obliged to keep them or give them, I think.
In the United States, you are not obliged, or
no? It's still the case. There. Of course, I mean, this is a great worry for me, as you can imagine, for the same reasons it'd be worried for you and our users. So far, I've heard of them being attached to certain bills, but again, you know, the people who are deciding on these things have no idea the consequences or the technical details of what's happening, and. You know, yeah, it's like, if we're obliged to keep logs, I think that some of us are going to prison. I mean, that's the only way it's going to happen.
We're never going to.
You know, I mean, even though I understand on some level it's a little bit of a red herring, because if someone has, if an agency has a warrant at the ISP level, then they can do quite a bit. But to be honest, in my years of working in data centers, and maybe they're hiding things from the techies or the people who know the network, which is me. But honestly, I've seen two or three times that level of federal interest, and it's all been around child pornography and Al Qaeda. Those are the two times I've seen it. Now, there definitely are times where they grab servers. More often, I've seen them grab servers. But again, you know, it's for things that are not necessarily political. And I'm concerned, and maybe this is the worry, is that it's perhaps because in the flood of the internet, we are irrelevant. Yep. I mean, just think about how much traffic we're pushing compared to, you know, a small size pornography site.
Yeah. I mean, porn is everything on the internet.
Well, it used to be.
Not just the internet.
It used to be everything. I'm not sure. My understanding is that the latest recession, at least in the U.S., has actually heavily impacted the pornography industry. So they're actually now having down quarters, pun not intended. But yeah, which is interesting, and I'm not sure what would change.
But so, I mean, whether we are irrelevant now or not, there are always peak moments. Summit going on somewhere or whatever, and it's quite nice to be prepared. And because when a summit is going on, when some events going on, you are sure to get raided, or that put you get a lot more pressure, of course.
Yeah. I'm curious to hear about your experience with your indie media site and the indie media network in general. Mm-hmm. I've always been very hesitant around indie media projects because they've always been high drama for seemingly low return. Mm-hmm. But now, most of the indie media sites in the U.S. are dead or dying, mm-hmm. you know, of which one of the biggest ones left is in the Bay Area called Indie Bay, which I'm sure you've heard of. Mm-hmm. And even in Europe, it seems like there's only three or four that are particularly active.
Well, we were sort of exception in Europe, or in the whole world, actually, whereas we chose from the beginning on to be completely independent on a tech level from the other indie medias in the world.
So what software do you use?
Well, we have our own servers. We hosted them, or replaced them at friendly hosting spaces. Mm-hmm. So we have complete control over our own network, even our own servers. So we're also completely independent from the other indie medias that are there. This dependence on other indie medias, which was also an issue which created as much drama for the other indie medias, of course. I mean, when India UK was taken down or whatever a couple of years ago, it took with it a lot of other indie medias, etc. So we also chose to not have too much contact with the other indie medias.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh.
There was some, of course, but not more than necessary.
So basically, they are DNS pointing, and that's about it. Not even their mailing list. It's not.
Not even the DNS server on the mailing list. Yeah, we're indie.net.
Oh.
Of course, there's this principles of unity and the indie media guidelines, which we take especially care of following these, of course.
But they're not that they're not that onerous, really.
Hmm?
They're not that difficult.
Really. No, not that difficult. Well, a little bit different, maybe when compared to other techie collectives, it's a little bit different. But for people who have their roots in activist movements, it's just completely normal. But of course, it's a little bit weird, because this principles of unity, for instance, state that an indie media collective is obliged to have open meetings, which are open for everybody, and everybody can join in the meetings. For a traditional tech club organization, it's quite weird.
Do you have a separate editorial group from a tech group?
No.
The tech group and the editorial group, they overlap.
Yeah. That's both healthy and
unhealthy. Yeah. Healthy because it probably means you don't disagree very often, but unhealthy because it means the size of your project is somewhat limited because, of course, like, yeah, this was one of the major things that happened in the Bay Area. Had a very famous split with their indie media. They had an SF.indiemedia and Indie Bay. They essentially ended up having a very big fight that I'm sure you may have heard this impacted the entire network because the tech group are the people who left. In other words, all the editorial people basically kept and kept Indie Bay, and all the tech people left, and they're the ones that created Active, which is, I think, the indie media software for 60, 70, maybe even more percentage of the indie media sites. And my understanding is they've never been heard from, I mean, or there's very little impact, or, sorry, they're not players anymore. They're basically all gone. I was just in Athens, and the Athens indie media is desperately trying to get off of Active. But as you can imagine, trying to migrate or do anything once you're stuck on a 10-year-old CMS software that hasn't really updated very often.
That's horribly familiar.
Only that's the difference was, to be honest, from beginning on, we did have a different, a separate editorial team from the tech team. The tech team was so small, only consisted of one or two people. Or even two mailing lists, but the tech mailing list isn't it?
Yeah. There's a tech mailing list.
Are the people on there?
I am on there.
When he's feeling lonely.
Last activity on this list has been 10 years ago, something like that. Our luck was maybe that we use a CMS, which is developed by a person who was also in the collective. So, yeah.
And did you move off of it, or are you still on it?
We're still on it. We are
reluctantly so by now.
We really want to get out of it. But, it's quite difficult, of course, because there are no real CMSs that are ready to use for something like IndieMedia at this moment. So.
You would move to Drupal, and it seems like that's what everyone's doing.
Yeah. I have my questions about Drupal. Securing anonymity is going to be a nightmare. Keeping up with the security patches is going to be a serious nightmare. And
although it's easier with Drash.
Yeah, but still, they're so frequent. And it's basically huge PHP bloat.
I mean, yes.
Yeah, I've had to administer Drupal websites as a farm and some individual websites for the last 5 years or so. It's always been a pain in the arse.
I have very little love for it from an admin perspective, but it is the most powerful CMS software out there in terms of having flexibility and having really good module systems.
I mean, to get a website up and running, it's wonderful. But to get the level of quality that I at least want to guarantee for an IndieMedia site in terms of security and anonymity,
it's horrible. I mean, I have to run scripts every hour to flush as many of the tables as possible, and I'm not sure I have them all. Actually, the last update, someone was bothering me because at the time you could view who voted on it kept the IPs of people who voted on polls. Why in the hell it would keep this IP information, boggles the mind. But there you have it.
Well, I think that's the nice thing about the media tech process, of course, is that they develop their own software.
Yeah.
So you have complete control over what you're doing. To move over to some third-party project, which has its problems, and
It has pros and cons.
We're still out.
Right now we're dependent only on one person, which is not exactly a very healthy situation either. It's very nice we have our own developer, but yeah. More of things get done when thousands of people collaborate to a project.
The CMS we are using now, it was developed 10 years ago, and it was 10 years ago.
State of the art is very different than today.
Exactly.
I gave a presentation in Greece on Facebook and Twitter, and you know, I don't know if you know about them, but they're amazing and incredible, and they've created revolutions all over North Africa. But part of that conversation is I said that indie media is basically starting to die, mm-hmm. and YouTube and other tools became so easy to use. Yeah. And of course, as we know, it's true.
I think indie media still has some unique features that you don't find in other sites. Like the whole open post, we discussed this yesterday, the whole open posting concept is still unique for a new site.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know any other specific news site that does open posting the way indie media does. There's all these social sites and blogs and aggregators and God knows what, where people can rent anything they want. But as a new site where groups can also anonymously put up their communication, it still deserves its space on the internet.
It's interesting to think politically what have been the positive and negative consequences of this. Because mm-hmm. most of the indie medias that have faded have mostly faded probably for the same reason that indie media was an incredible project. In other words, you know, there are only so many 9/11 stories that you can have before people start to run away from the site, which is definitely what's happened in the Bay.
So you could sort of state that indie media became irrelevant, just like our hack labs of the late 90s became irrelevant as well, obsolete in some way. When you say that's the function of indie media has been taken over by all these new...
Partly. I mean, as an easy way to post random stuff on the internet for any user, this has been taken over by any social network you can think of, and there's 1,001 ways for anyone to post anything on the internet.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, as I said before, as a news site, I still think it deserves its place on the internet. It's not being obsoleted as such.
Other than 4chan.
4chan is not a news site.
What? Right. Then I got it completely wrong.
You were using it for credible sources.
I use it to give myself some sense of credibility.
Yeah. But also from the perspective of anonymity, I mean, especially all the commercial providers, they're especially not interested in anonymity because they can sell the data.
Right.
So these two bite.
But this is an argument that, while it's very convincing to us, it's always been one of the hardest arguments for end users, even political end users. You know, most political end users, over who are having this conversation, seem to think that as long as they have Tor running, then they're fine.
Yeah.
Most end users aren't really even running Tor, so
no.
Most end users don't give a shit about their privacy or whatever, and they think Facebook is fine to share political or activist information with other activists because it's so easy to use, and all these Linux techie nerds are anyway and user unfriendly.
The other thing you nowadays even hear from activist people is like, yeah, but the good parts from using Facebook outweigh the bad parts. That's a slippery slope.
Mm-hmm.
That's where it becomes dangerous.
Yeah, no, I've heard that argument quite a few times, and from the perspective of a traditional activist who's trying to get people at their events.
It's the classical case of like making sure that you get short-term benefits in exchange for long-term benefits. And that's the whole issue then.
Hmm. What do you mean by that?
Well, for example, your short-term benefit is that you get more people for your action. Your long-term problem is that you sell away everything. So it's like short-term versus long-term. In that regard, short-term is useful. Long-term is very, very bad, okay?
I'm curious as to what extent you've tried to leverage other internet projects through indie media. In other words, have you thought very much, or have you done much work in regards to maybe having other sites that do other things than the news? And to what extent has that been successful?
Maybe you can tell bits about Open Radio.
Yeah. Well, we had a site for a couple of years called Open Radio, which was basically an indie media, but we completely focused on radio. The site looked like a calendar, a schedule for a radio show. And any empty slot in the schedule, you could upload your MP3, and it would play everything in, mix everything into one stream.
Wow, neat.
Stream that out, yeah.
And what happened?
Nobody posted.
It was literally empty for a couple of years. Yeah,
pretty much. Yeah, I think in its 2-3 year existence, it maybe 30-40 posts or something.
So this was an advertising problem.
Yeah, and it was even pretty well advertised in general, but there's simply very few people that make radio here.
Huh. Interesting.
There were also some technical problems.
Yeah.
Of course.
It's,
there are actually some people who are picking the idea up and doing a rewrite. So it's not completely dead yet, but different people.
What? Okay. Then, you know, putting up, setting up a radio, internet radio or radio whatever, or setting up a video broadcasting thing, anything more than just taking your video, uploading it to YouTube, or forget it, fire and forget anything other than that is quite hard to do. Well, it's not really hard. In technical terms, it's quite easy, but it takes a lot of time and resources, and you have to set up everything, and you have to, you know, you have to prepare it, and you have to think about what I'm going to say. And,
The Anarchist News actually, about 4 years ago, I spun up a standalone IRC server. So, and essentially waited. And eventually people started to come on. I'm sure there's at least 4 or 5 people who are on it right now. And because of that standalone chat server, slowly but surely, other web projects have come out of the anarchistnews.org. It might seem surprising because if you've seen the site, many people complain about it because it's very antisocial. Some of 4chan culture has come to Anarchist News, which of course seems strange, but there's lots of like memes, anarchist memes, that have essentially come out of the comments section.
Sounds pretty sweet.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting in this way, you know, the meme pictures.
Mm-hmm.
There's one that has this kid who looks like a classic Black Bloc kid, and he's called the Anarchy Dude, and there's like hundreds and hundreds of different variations of the Anarchy Dude, you know, three word chant. and because of this channel and because of some of the needs of the and desires of the people who came into this channel, we actually created Anok Chan. So it's actually a related project, and if you go to anokchan.org, maybe it's .com, but either way, you'll find it. And there's lots of these sort of funny sorts of things. But the more interesting or respectable project that came out of this was this project called the Anarchist Library.
Mm-hmm.
So this was me and about four or five other people. And the English language anarchist archives, there were 3 or 4 that had been started since the history of the internet, including one from the Netherlands called Spunk.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Right, very well known, really, really interesting, and you know, he attempted to do an archive. Yeah. But if you actually went there and tried to read anything, it was all utter shit. Right, it was really bad OCRs in the early days of OCR software. Mm-hmm. It was just very, very bad, and more importantly, hadn't been looked at in 10 years.
Yeah.
So we took the best of Spunk, the best of all of the other archives, and essentially said, you know, here are our criteria. We're going to do everything, so no sectarianism allowed, except for... and so the except for's are, of course, the anarcho-capitalists,
and the brand new anarcho-nationalists, who you may have heard of a little bit, and we can talk about them. But the problem is they're active on the internet, so they definitely have tried to sneak in. But so we upload everything, and we do everything in our power to stay active as in terms of an archive. Like pretty much at least 5 days of the week, there's new uploads, which is pretty incredible. Mm-hmm. And then the third thing, and this is the big thing from the techie perspective, is that we force people to use guidelines in terms of their uploads, and then the uploads basically dump into a LaTeX file, and out of that LaTeX file comes the HTML that makes the eventual web page of the text. Also comes 4 PDFs, a US PDF, imposed PDF, A3 PDF, and then imposed A3 PDF. So it really is this incredible project where many of the uploads are books. So the if you've ever tried to play around with LaTeX imposed sort of stuff, it's very hard to do bigger and bigger things in an imposed fashion. So our once you get above a certain page count, the imposed actually makes signatures, just like a book. It really is like the person who did the work for this, he's actually in Croatia, and he's just like, he's become a madman at LaTeX, which is more or less like about as black magic as you get nowadays.
Yeah.
and I use it as an opportunity to learn, you know, as much as I could about LaTeX, because of course, again, right, it's really interesting. It's really neat. I love it conceptually. It's such a mindfuck when you're used to even just used to text is how you operate with textual data. But so this project, the Anarchist Library, if you've ever seen it, it really has been an amazing success. And actually, one of the tables here that's tabling this weekend has like 10 or 12 different zines that are just straight out copies from the Anarchist Library. And that, for me, feels like a total, like a successful tech project, like an actual successful tech project, you know?
Yeah, it's also, quite, both in purpose and in the actual technical implication. Very impressive.
Yeah. And it all started from a chat room, like this.
Yeah. Also video, or that's for something later?
Yeah, honestly, I've never felt compelled about video for some of these same reasons. I tend to find video content to attract the, to put it bluntly, the least interesting kind of consumer of content.
Mm-hmm.
And this is one of the reasons I've been hesitant about even moving to audio. Mm-hmm. You know, I tend to find, in terms of an audience that I want to appeal to, and whatever, this brings us into a very different discussion, but Anarchist News, as much as I love it as a project, oftentimes I feel like I'm creating this 4chan
subculture.
Essentially these this generation of people whose exposure to the internet is very different than mine, and whose purpose for being here I find somewhat suspect. And video basically almost takes that sort of logic and takes it kind of further.
No, I don't think that's so. The two defining things with like the whole chat culture, it's the first thing is fast. The second thing is interactive.
Mm-hmm.
Like video isn't, video is not fast or interactive. To make a reply to a video is very slow. You have to film something yourself, mm-hmm. that takes time. So the conceptual difference between something like chance, like 4chan, and videos is vastly different.
Well, I accept what you'll say, or what you're saying. What I'm trying to get at is the sense of paying attention to the kind of audience that you're trying to reach, and that the audience that I haven't reached with Anarchist News, sometimes I feel resentful of myself for having reached them, but separately, the kind of people who I see who pay a lot of attention to video on the internet, specifically anarchist video, by and large, I don't feel like I have much desire to reach them. So, by and large, it's people who are doing very introductory sort of material. You know, by and large, it's people talking to webcams. And I would love the idea and would totally be willing to do a project that was more
that involved like people wanting to become directors and making films, something like this. If someone came to me with that sort of a project in mind, I would love it.
Mm-hmm.
But something that just ends up being another, that's trying to outcompete YouTube at what they're very, very good at.
For me, also, of course, there have been zillions of very good documentaries in the past, over the last 80 years.
Mm-hmm.
Very good films and professional stuff as well, also underground stuff that nobody has ever even heard of, or stuff from universities from the 60s, for instance, which is still rotting away somewhere in the archives, probably, spread around the world. It's stuff like that that's interesting as well.
Stuart Christie has an incredible collection of exactly the sort of thing.
Who?
Stuart Christie. It's called ChristieFilms.org or something. .uk.org or whatever the extension is, org.uk, I think. Yeah, and I had had some conversations with him when he was looking for a host at one point, and probably been willing to help him out, but he found someone else before we closed the deal. Have you had success with video yourselves?
We've tried. There are some other tech. And I guess Tim is running here in Netherlands as well. Squat.net is more than one of the others. There was a page called video.squat.net, which tried to be an archive of Dutch squatter culture films or European squatter culture films.
And what happened?
It was sort of popular within the scene, of course. But it took a lot of effort to. Took a lot of bandwidth, mostly.
That's actually my question. Is at what point does the bandwidth become, like, how much? Was it 10 megs, 20 megs? Did it ever get to a measurable?
I don't have figures, but I suppose it could to two-thirds of the complete bandwidth used by the website. I don't know.
No, I think the bandwidth was not even that much the issue, because it was never so extremely popular that people were continuously reaching, but it was mostly the continuous use of disk space. 90% of the server was filled with videos.
One of the issues also, maybe also why it never was so popular, is because the presentation for it was shit.
Yeah.
It was just an Apache directory listing.
Or which I might
You could have clicked and watched it. It works.
The whole look and feel of SquatNet is way back to 97. That's
anyway, it's, when the presentation was shit, or when it was, of course, it was very crude, but still it was.
And were you just running this off of Apache? Like, you weren't trying to do anything special with the...
Oh, we have been playing around with Pulumi, for instance, to see if we could put a nice front net for it. It took a lot of time, and was nice as it was. So.
But it's still alive.
On the to-do list.
Mm-hmm. But it's still alive, isn't it?
Stay taken down at this moment.
Yeah, sure.
So it's just a list of the films that were there, but the films aren't actually there.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Because the films are still, there's... They're still somewhere, but...
I think they are away as well. They're backed up somewhere. But
yeah, a few places.
Yeah, I have a backup of them.
Christie does actually accomplish this for a lot of the sort of obscure... he has a political focus.
Mm-hmm.
But, and then very recently, CrimeThink... came out with a similar sort of video portal sort of thing. As you can probably tell, I'm doing a lot for one person. perhaps if I had some people who were more focused on this, bandwidth is probably a lot cheaper in the US than it is here.
Mm-hmm.
How much do you pay for a server?
I have 10 megs in a box in a cooler space right now for like 100, about 100 euro.
A month?
Or? Yeah.
It's expensive.
That's expensive, Okay.
But with the 10 megs of bandwidth? That's 10 megs a second.
10 megabits, sorry.
Yeah.
That's so great.
Well, that's pretty fucking great, actually.
100 euros?
Oh, flat rate. No limits.
Oh, no limits.
100 megs, 10 megs all the time. It's only when you exceed measurable 10. Yeah.
It's a 95%
Right.
Yeah. Okay.
And to go to 100 megs, I think, would be a couple hundred dollars more, but I mean, that's pretty serious bandwidth.
True.
For purpose, it's good enough.
I mean, I think that is measurable. We had a rough number as I think it was 4,000 gigs a month was 4 terabyte a month was five megs. So
yeah.
So I guess that's 8,000 gigs.
Mm.
Not bad. I mean, again, it's always this balancing of resources and you know, how can you do what you want, like I think part of my problem is now my this server that I'm giving you the cost on is it's a 2U server. If I would have just put in a 1U server, it would have cost, you know, X number of dollars less.
Mm.
And you know, you always are ridiculous things, but you know, it also has like over 2 terabyte of disk space. So yeah, I'm actually kind of excited to put in either a server here or on the East Coast, mostly just to see what kinds of things I can play around with. But it probably is totally irrelevant, and I'm just kind of dancing with myself. But this is the exciting things you can do, you know.
Mm-hmm. So it would allow you to establish a more firm contact with the scene in Europe, of course.
Right. No, I mean, that's, for me, it's somewhat important. Mostly, I mean, like, I have to say, you know, you all are pretty, I've not met another group who's as together as you all are. And
I think one thing that really plays a big role in that is that we started off as a physical space. Yeah. And we all know each other face to face. We've done bar shift together for years. That makes a huge difference compared to most of the tech collective.
Yeah, like we also known each other like outside of this for like 10 years.
Yeah, no,
so
that's a huge thing.
Yeah.
We play war games together. So.
Yeah. War games, different games, games with eels.
Yeah.
Long stories.
Yeah, actually, I.
Bad intro jokes.
Yeah, I mean, the very different thing is that in the U.S., it's like political people who want to know tech generally are so young in their tech that for me they're not that useful to work with, and people who can keep up with me from the tech perspective generally aren't political.
Yeah.
And so the only other real serious techs in my area are all in the indie media, and I mean more power to them. They actually live about, you know, 4U from me, but you know, it just ends up being a very different project because, and maybe this is something that's interesting to talk about, it's very hard for me to do tech projects that take so much of my time and everything for charity.
Mm-hmm.
With that sense of like, that I'm serving people who I don't necessarily like what they're doing politically, and that the only reason I'm doing it is out of some sort of sense of obligation, you know, to the cause or to the, some sort of abstract movement.
Which brings me on to something I just thought about. Mm-hmm. Of course, we are not the first group in the Netherlands which is closely knit as ours and which is politically active. There were groups before us as well. Now we are third or fourth generation, but you know, we are not the pioneers of the internet community or whatever in the Netherlands. And there have been techies active in the 1980s already, or even in the 1970s, who were politically active as well.
Man.
Yeah,
that's amazing. It really is.
Yeah.
There's no continuity like that in the U.S.
No, but there's no real continuity here as well. Oh. There is some overlap, of course, but because when we started in our collective, the old guys were still sort of active. We more or less took over. So our knowledge is a little bit less than theirs, and our influence is a little bit less than theirs. I'm talking about Access for All, for instance,
Yeah, that's a funny thing. One of the biggest Dutch ISPs originated from a group that called themselves techno-anarchists.
Interesting. There were a bunch of, like, part of them were squatters, and they were one of the first to have a little sun machine with a couple of dial-up lines, and that was their ISP. Yeah. And they publicized a magazine on, like, how to break into VM CMS systems and, like, esoteric stuff like that.
So there, it was your equivalent to 2600?
Yeah, essentially. It's quite similar to 2600. So
connected.
It was also connected. So there's still a bit of, like, inspiration for later generations as well. But there's little overlap. Like, I met some of the people who used to be in Hectic, but not much any contact.
I mean, they're complete fucking corporate sellouts nowadays.
Yeah, that's true as well.
Language, but,
they sold off. They had like this. They start small ISP. Like, it started with this one sun machine, and then it became a whole rack, whatever. And then at some point they incorporated themselves as a little ISP called Texas for All. And then it's now 2 or 3 years ago. They sold themselves.
No, longer.
Longer already.
Much longer.
Well, anyway, several years ago they sold the whole their privately owned ISP company to the biggest telecom corporation in the Netherlands.
And slowly the quality is going down, and they stopped idealistic hosting.
Because the ISP was still fairly known for doing, like, it was always expensive, like Access for All, but they did cool shit. Like, if you got an account, they had 12 Unix servers running FreeBSD on which you had a shell account.
Right.
Like, no other ISP had that. They had a real Usenet server, anything. And
that's a more political project. They subsidized a lot of rack space.
Some activist groups, they were hosted there for free, like symbolic prices, whatever.
For free, even. If you were a political relevant group, you just went to them and you said, okay, here I am. I'm a political relevant group, please give me some space.
And they were also in some court cases and stuff. Related to, like, the European and Dutch equivalents of the EFF and stuff like that.
And Scientology.
And Scientology. Yeah. Against Scientology.
Right. Yeah, definitely.
But, yeah, that sort of has died off now.
Huh. Spahn came from this generation as well.
So yeah. Oh, really?
Yeah.
Did you ever know him, the Jack guy?
No.
Oh. Interesting. Yeah, I think that for us, you know, of course, the Bay Area also does have older generations and all the rest.
Yeah, the Bay Area has the whole history with, like, the Berkeley system.
You may have heard of Berkeley, California, where I live.
Yeah, there's two things out of Berkeley, BSD 4.4 and LSD.
We do not believe this to be a coincidence.
Yeah.
Well, we had a joke about it today. It was just a small control project.
Right.
But the politics actually hasn't necessarily been as much as the tech. In other words, by and large, the larger tech community you would call lefty liberal within an American political context. You know, they probably vote Democrat, but it's not by any stretch even aware of more radical political movements.
We're just kind of surprising, because, for example, I just mentioned, like, BSD, but BSD is, like, essentially the original open source project. It existed way before GNU or anything else did.
But out of BSD came Sun Microsystems.
Yeah, essentially, that was the commercial spin-off, yeah.
The giants
but
of the industry.
That's not really true. Also, what you just say, you know what the abbreviation SUN stands for? Stanford University Network. It didn't came from BSD. It didn't came from Berkeley. It came from Stanford, and it was also not directly related.
Bill Joy was the was the connection.
Yeah,
Bill Joy. In other words, the point here is that you can talk about ideologies, but these are actually particular people who are all still alive.
Well, it fascinates me what you just described, because remember from San Francisco, the noise bridge, the hackerspace. I was amazed at how politicized it is.
Yeah, it is.
In comparison to the new style hackerspaces that we have them here in Europe, here it's just kids playing with Arduinos.
Yeah, it's kids playing with some toys they buy off the internet, and essentially there's no personal creativity involved in it either, which is really depressing to see.
But I'll point directly, the reason why NoiseBridge is as political as it is that the direct founder, the person who started it, is Jacob Applebaum. He basically is the political founder of the project, mm-hmm. and he now works for Tor, mm-hmm. and he's been a light anarchist for a long time. Mm-hmm. So it really just speaks to his personal influence far more than the culture there. I just gave a presentation there in April, mm-hmm. and they were not interested in the politics. Mm-hmm. They were interested mm-hmm. in the tech and the legal stuff. They were not interested in the politics.
So that's true.
Yeah. Now that said, you know, there are some, you know, like one of the people who I'd mentioned to you was this person named Moxie Mildenspank. He's somewhat pretty well known right now in the hacker circles, international hacker circles, because he published at DEF CON the last two or three years. He's been giving the big presentations about SSL hacking. Mm-hmm. And he also has a company called WhisperNet that's doing cell phone encrypted SMS and encrypted cell phone calling.
Everything I know from WhisperNet is very dodgy, so to say.
Sure. No, absolutely. I'm not defending him. I'm just saying that as a someone who's well known, he all his work happens at NoiseBridge. You know, the other thing that NoiseBridge has that's really interesting is it doesn't have quite so much of a, like, it definitely feels like a clubhouse, but it feels like a clubhouse of chaos. So there's no real, it's not really tightly bound to, like, if you don't come in, if you come in the door and you don't look quite right, no one cares.
Yeah, it was really nice to be able to ring the bell and walk in and eventually end up crashing on their sofa.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
Good old days.
Not so dissimilar from, like, the Chaos Computer Club in Germany, from the sound of it.
Nice.
Way more open than CC nowadays.
Yeah, true.
So, I mean, I definitely am impressed with the project. The funny thing about the Bay Area is that Berkeley and Oakland, Berkeley and San Francisco are really a 15-minute motorcycle ride, mm-hmm. but it seems like you never go there unless you have to. In other words, that water, which is the mm-hmm. bay that separates them, like it seems like much bigger than it is, and so most of the time people don't like, if they live in San Francisco, they do work and they do projects in San Francisco. If they live in the East Bay, which is Berkeley and Oakland, they stay there. So while I've been there a few times, I don't hang out there at all.
I just wanted to. There is some kind of difference, of course, between the political techies or the techie political guys.
Right.
Yeah. So for instance, we, or at least me, I see open software or free software as a tool, and also, you know, everything connected to open software, the ideology behind it. Mm. It's a perfect tool to liberate the masses, or however you could call it.
the masses defined by wires, yes.
The wires want to be free, and anyway.
Software be free, software be free.
And, well, when you look at the hacker conferences here in Europe, for instance, or at CC, they are quite political, especially CC is quite political. But they are limited in the politics. They're striving for a free internet and free software, and software that remains to be free, and that's about it.
It's all
they care about.
It's all within legalistic context.
Well, or yeah.
It's all within legalistic context.
Yeah. So of course we share something, but we're also a little bit
But I also, like, in the last 1 year, 2 years, there's been like a big rise again on like non-legalistic internet activism.
Which all is all anonymous.
Well, that's only one of them, actually. Which is...
Yeah.
It's a bit... the bummer is a bit that a lot of the... Oh, that's a bit tiny. A lot of the targets and stuff, it's like bit narrow, and some of them are like, yeah, it's cool that you guys managed to crack a network from Sony, but...
Yeah, but that's all within... within the context of privacy and network policy, of course.
Sure.
And it's never about about labor or women's rights or about gay rights or whatever.
No, I know.
Well, so I think Anonymous is slowly...
Anonymous
is getting more and more...
Anonymous is fairly politicized.
Have you seen the attempts at anarchist intervention into Anonymous?
Oh yeah, those were hilarious.
Yeah.
They were fairly bad attempts as well.
And were they?
Yeah, and they were pretty stupid anyway.
Have you seen the blog? I would love some, yeah. Have you seen the blog Vanzetti's Ghost? This person wrote a series of like 4 or 5 essays about, essentially, from an anarchist perspective about Anonymous, rather than from a techie perspective, as a source of intervention. And I recommend checking it out, mostly just because it's really, the attempt is really interesting. Of course, I kind of agree that it's doomed to failure and doomed to looking really embarrassing from the Anonymous side, but it is at least very interesting.
Anonymous is structured internally very, sort of like semi-Darwinist or anarchic inside of it, and that works actually surprisingly well.
Mm-hmm. You have to have a lot of time to be effective with them, yeah?
Sorry?
You have to be willing to... stare at the screen and be in a chat room for
all the people who like really get somewhere within Anonymous, all people who've been there for months.
Yeah.
If not more than a year.
Yeah.
There's like Anonymous is it looks like a mask, but it isn't.
No, of course.
It's a facade essentially, but it works great. The whole system, the whole method works great, and that's the nice thing as a. It's a bit bummer that the targets are a bit boring. Well, they're fun, actually, but... Anyway... Is that... it's essentially...
it's amazing to me to see that their attack against Amazon Web Services failed.
Yeah. But what I mean to say is, like... I think this point came up yesterday during the Q&A in your presentation as well. You have, like, the thing with, like... You have, like, if you would say it would be a militant force... A bit exaggerating, but you do essentially illegalist violent action which against financial property, so I think it's valid. What you essentially combine is a force which is both does like exactly in Engels grote actie, spectacular actions, still maintain like anonymity down to the name. But their anonymity is based on a pre-constructed form of aesthetics, so which reinforce the whole spectacular part. So you can reinforce your whole action by essentially like the whole construction of the group, which is, in my opinion, a really good construction.
It's the same as the Black Bloc, except with different masks.
It is essentially a Black Bloc, but with a much better outward view.
It's a Guy Fawkes
one. No. There is one big dividing difference here. One of the big dividing points of like the Anonymous aesthetic, essentially, is completely fake anyway, but that doesn't really matter, is that anybody can join it. Mm-hmm. And it's much more openly advertised that it's a joinable group. It's not like, 200 guys in black masks who stand all locked in, and there's not so much like, come join us. The Anonymous group is much more openly organized.
The Black Bro Flock is a close group.
By definition. Anonymous is not a close group by definition.
But actually, advertising...
That's fucking bullshit.
No, the Black Bloc is definitely a close group. It presents itself like that. Also, in mainstream demonstrations, there's a demonstration and there's a big Black Bloc.
If I happen to want to join a Black Bloc, I can at any time put on some black clothes, put on a black glove, and walk straight in.
That's because you share,
Because we share some.
That's because I can adopt the aesthetics that are pretty fine.
Well, it's not just aesthetics. No.
Yeah, it's...
Maybe you should...
We have a... like, I know exactly what you mean. Like, we've been there, done that, you know? The whole thing is, like, we share a pre-existing affinity with these groups.
Not necessarily. I mean, it even works in other parts of the world where I don't know anyone.
Yeah, but you still share, like, the pre-existing knowledge of what the Black Bloc is.
But by that argument, the same as Anonymous, yeah.
You know what lawyers...
You just happen to overlap with both groups.
Yeah, but they're, yeah, it's a bit unfair to say that there's no level drempelwaarde, the verschillende drempelwaarde. There's no, there's a huge difference in barrier level.
There's quite a barrier for Anonymous as well.
Yeah.
You have to know IRC. You have to know a shitload of memes. You have to know what the fuck these channels are about and get into this whole subculture of things.
But it's much more easy to get into. And the Blockers or some anarchist subculture.
And it's also much more opener because how many fucking kids read 4chan?
Only if you assume internet savviness, but...
Yeah.
Okay, but in the Western world... Okay, Western
I just got back from Greece. Nobody there is internet savvy. Almost nobody. Yeah.
The Black Bloc, on the other hand, is very easily accessible if you have a bit of riot savviness. It's... Which also comes from...
Also, you really need to know the unwritten rules, because the rules of the Black Bloc are not written. And you really need to know them in order to participate, or even to feel comfortable in such a Black Bloc.
Yeah, but the same goes for Anonymous. It's never written...
Essentially, every action in which
Anonymous... The obvious things like use a fucking proxy is hardly ever written down.
No, but... No.
Thank you very much.
But now we get into a discussion... Now you get to the discussion of implements. Like, any action to which Anonymous is mentioned... usually includes a link to the website of AnonOps.
Mm-hmm.
AnonOps, the front page starts with the introductionary manifesto to what is Anonymous, which contains literally everything in one A4 or less. It's a flyer-sized leaflet containing essentially the whole founding principles and guidelines of what is Anonymous. Mm-hmm. So essentially, it's all written down.
Similarly, though, if you search for Black Bloc rules in your search engine of choice, most likely you come up with an A4 page.
But Black Blocs don't advertise for come and join us.
Anonymous actively does.
Well, not very well. I haven't seen it.
No, because the Black Bloc discussion is just like the Autonomen discussion. The Black Bloc does not exist.
Right.
Whereas Anonymous does exist. Which is the difference.
Yeah. Would you mind if we stop this?
I don't care. You don't care.
I don't care. He was already rolling.
Shall I complain or? I'm
about to open the door.
Yeah, sure. Well spoken.
Empty bottles of beer.
9 non-bottles of beer on the wall. Tossed around, guilt tossed around,
just imagine, you're a 15-year-old kid, you're angry at the world, you're angry with the police, you're angry with everything, you want to do something about it, and you decide to join up on a demonstration. It's really, really hard to approach a Black Bloc, or approach the Autonomen, or whatever, and try to get near it.
Hell yeah, been there, done that.
Yeah.
Yeah, the 15-year-old kid was also like, maybe not. No, but I mean, like...
You wanted to yeah.
Well, I was going to head in the other direction, which is to say, let's talk a little bit about Anonymous tactics. Because while someone who is savvy may know that going through a proxy is going to save your ass, my guess is that Tor nodes are hammered during days of...
There's no sense in doing DDoS attacks through proxies.
It doesn't... Right.
It doesn't work.
Right. And so as a result, the question I have is...
It's very utilitarian to instigate the masses to take the damage for you. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, the thing though that what is much more interesting within Anonymous, I think, is that you see that there's a big shift being from going from kids DDoSing to Anonymous actually having members with like real actual skills.
Yeah, actually, well, before we go to that, because I do my job includes some networking stuff,
mm-hmm.
and in my estimation, given what I know about data center topology nowadays,
mm-hmm.
I give DDoS attacks in the way that they're currently constructed 3 to 4 years maximum before almost any data center in the world can handle them with relative ease.
Yeah.
And, you know, really it's going to end up just being another appliance that Cisco sells. And the question for really is, like, to what extent, just like other radical activism, are we providing the tools for systems of domination and control, the ways in which they can become more better and more improved.
Mm-hmm.
So these people who have more impact, I mean, the perfect case that you're referring to with Anonymous was the security company in California. This is an incredible story. I mean, this really is the vindication of something.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, this is essentially that they said, we're going to this conference, we're gonna unmask Anonymous, we're gonna tear them asunder, and instead, essentially, the company is gone. They decimated the company in 24 hours.
I think to make the analogy with the BlackRock again, it's a bit of a dangerous path to go as well, because you close yourself down to a very elitist small group, because there's only very, very few people who actually have the means to pull off these kind of stunts.
Nerd!
Okay.
What?
I
don't
think you're
tired.
You
want to
do
that?
Okay.
We have coffee. No, that's...
Can I finish?
Yeah.
What I was saying, that this move towards more high-tech, more skilled actions, I see it in a way as a move towards from black bloc tactics to more underground direct action in small cells, which
uh-huh.
is a dangerous path to be walking.
Now, the thing here though is that what you would have within a black bloc, you would have that it would be like at some point it becomes like visible and noticeable that like some people are way more into it than some others, so to say. The thing is, with like the GB Harry thing, 90% of Anonymous was not aware that this was actually being done by people from Anonymous.
Mm-hmm.
It was not done on hash anon, so to say.
No consensus was taken. Yeah.
There is no consensus within it. There's only mass movement, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't really have this effect. The only other effect that you have is that suddenly, the day after, the other 90% of Anonymous
mm-hmm.
reads in the channel topic, hey, some guys did this in our name, and that only works really inspiring.
Can I pull back for a second and ask a techie question, because I don't actually know. How does LOSC get pointed? How does it get sent to a target? Do you have to copy and paste an IP address or a URL into the thing?
Yeah, the big anonymous mass, so to say, they all sit on one RSC channel,
mm-hmm.
and also on some, also just actually 4chan, and it just gets posted there. And it's essentially just mass aggregation, how it works. If something gets reposted and re-mentioned again, that becomes like the most copied IP address and the most mentioned one, thus it gets into the topic or gets on the high spot in 4chan, and thus that's the one people select to put into whatever DDoS tool they use. It's not like it gets decided on in consensus. It's essentially, mass spearing against mass. That's how it works.
It's basically when you have several actions or something going on and people go to different actions.
Interesting.
Not really. Not
it's
at all.
It's a bit like the Greek method of having not one organization for a demonstration, but shitloads of assemblies that each print their own flyer.
Yeah, and same thing.
If a thousand different assemblies pick it up and print the flyer, you'll have a fucking huge demo, whereas if two, then you have 10 people walking around through the city.
Yeah. Okay, back to where you're at.
That was the analogy with going more underground and into... Mm-hmm. I'm kind of lost to where that was aiming at.
The relationship.
Yeah, I see it as a shame. I'm a bit afraid that will replace the DDoS attacks and the mass attacks.
Yeah, but the other side is a bit like, really purely technical speaking, mm-hmm. if it just stays at DDoS attacks. Like Aragon says, the movement is dead in a couple of years, yeah. and I'd rather keep. Not yeah, no, really, it's dead. I don't. Yeah, it's dead.
You don't think that?
You don't? No, really, man.
On the application level, sure.
Sure.
Well, the networks can handle it, but the servers themselves.
No, my point is that the network devices will basically be sniffing layer 4. Mm-hmm. That essentially the blocks will be a lot more sophisticated on the network layer, which will prevent the applications from even seeing the packets.
Like, yeah. First, like,
I've started to see these tools. Mm-hmm. We have some of these river guards.
Yeah.
The river guards of the last data center that I was at, they had just upgraded from one that could take 1 gig of traffic
mm-hmm.
to 10 gigs of traffic.
It's, and what does it do?
It does intelligent packet inspection.
Yeah, just look at it abstractly.
Sorry, let me just make one more point, which is a point I made to you yesterday. Mm-hmm. While I was there, mm-hmm. Our data center went down from a 2 gig packet storm mm-hmm. from China mm-hmm. against a service that we were hosting that was hosting pictures of Tibet.
Mm-hmm.
So in other words, the motivations for creating these devices isn't just to fight against an anonymous.
No, of course not.
This is the future of warfare, you know.
Yeah.
Which I'm sure Vietnam is happy about this late development.
Sorry, yeah, but then it's a matter of finding a new means to to have mass online action. Be it DDoS or whatever. I mean, even crowding the forums of a website in... spam the fucking hell out of it. In the end, if you have a huge mass, you can think of any simple destructive thing. And
yeah, but the level of financial, economic damage and disruption you do with that, it's not that big anymore. It gets really diminished.
But that's not the point.
But you want to inflict damage, don't you?
You want to be visible. You want to inflict damage, but you also want to be visible. It's like a demonstration.
Well, the bigger damage you inflict, the bigger invisibility you get.
I doubt
simple as that.
Anonymous is really motivated on that level, actually.
Depends on the personal level of
on
the people who are
protest
involved.
Level, you mean, or
yeah, I'm really doubtful about the motives of Anonymous.
I want to be honest. It's a bit we're talking about Anonymous, but that's also just one of the groups
mm-hmm.
which exist. There's nearly 10 active groups at the moment. We were like busy with this. You have like the other really big one at the moment is Lulzak. And Lulzak is doing really cool shit. And
they've only been active a month or something, yeah.
Lulzak has been active for a longer time.
Yeah.
But they're not directly related to Anonymous at all. But they've been doing really impressive stuff. Like they've been doing a campaign about it's an actual organized campaign. About users' identities and how they're really easily exploitable. The big hack they did was the exploitation of the online gaming platform for the PlayStation 3,
mm-hmm.
in which they got 65 million username accounts, passwords, home addresses, telephone addresses, and just put them up on a torrent website. And they did this by now for, I think, 8 or 9 different platforms, including some governmental instances and a bank. No, not a bank, a security company. And
I must say, their PR department fucking sucks.
it doesn't really matter anymore. The whole message which gets out, like
the PR of LoLsec.
Yeah, but
are we talking here about angry consumers who are worried about their identity on a service they pay for? Or are we talking here about politically motivated agitators?
Yeah, but that's the thing. Yeah. That's the thing. Yeah.
You could be hackers from Nintendo.
What you just said, slight detour. This actually gets done as well. It's a bit of a specific market, but you have like this whole market for encryption of TV signals, and it gets constantly cracked. And it's a well-known industry secret. There's actually been court cases over it. There's four different competing companies. They all have different encryption methods, and they all crack each other. Like, there's been one big court case of, like, the two biggest are Secom and Airdata, and there's been a public leak that Airdata was the ones reversed Secom's algorithm, then posted on Usenet a C file how to generate encryption keys. So this actually does exist. Yeah. This completely exists. This is no fiction or anything. But what I want to say would like...
Gibson was right!
Hell yeah.
Oh, that's Sterling.
Doesn't matter, Cyberpunk is awesome. I just want my neural mind link, for fuck's sake.
Sterling was in the Netherlands a couple of years ago to give a lecture and on these topics, but okay.
But I want to say, what the thing about like these big cracks like from LoLsec and... I forget the name, there's another big group active at the moment. Anyway, it doesn't matter what their motivation is. What they crack at the moment are big issues.
Yeah.
Big issues both from the perspective of privacy, consumers who get pissed off because have you ever read the license agreement for the PlayStation 3? It's really weird. You think you buy a machine to buy games. Yeah, fuck that. So that's not really the issue. What it does is like it makes it like in blatantly obvious that there's that like how incredibly weak and everything it is, and then other people can decide for themselves why this is fucked up. But you just give them the wake up slap in the face.
But the agenda is still quite limited. Agenda is still quite limited.
Nah, why would the agenda be limited if you like you crack such a variety of big nice things? Mm-hmm. Why would your agenda be limited then?
The political agenda.
It's only about in regards to privacy.
True, but yeah.
I mean,
you can't focus on everything.
The point that I would see to you is that it's not like any of these actions are going to change the nature of privacy within our lifetime, which does take it outside of the political spectrum. Yeah. In other words, these are embarrassing for the companies. They perhaps might eventually percolate to some sort of legislative action. But by and large, all of this just seems to be froth, rather than...
Essentially, this is the same as the black bloc smashing up an ATM, then.
No.
That...
Sadly, yeah.
Yeah, with the slight difference that the black bloc hasn't at least the aim for insurrection.
Yeah, but you don't do an insurrection by smashing up a bank.
Well, it might very well start.
Maybe.
Two banks? Three banks?
Well, okay. If we crack all publicly accessible databases in the world, make all information free, right. Don't we then get into cyberpunk utopia? Okay, who of us is winning here? Who of us is having the nicer insurrection? I'm for the cyberpunk utopia. If it's going to be anything like Shadowrun, I'm in.
I think I'm for smashing all the banks, personally. I vote for smashing all the banks.
Shadowrun, man.
No, but for example, there is one big company in the Netherlands which has been active and operating for the last 20 years already. They started 20 years ago as a company exploring possibilities of that personal identifying on basis of biometrics. They have a huge office somewhere in the western part of the Netherlands. They've been developing electronics for all that, and they're now developing electronics for our new funky passports, etc.
Which one is that? Signal?
No, it's not Signal. No. I forgot the name now, it doesn't really matter. I've yet to see anonymous take no action against them.
No, but that's maybe because of the exact reason which you say. It doesn't really matter. I mean, who knows them? I actually don't know them by name.
Oh, yeah. Actually, let's reframe the conversation. Mm-hmm. To some extent, anonymous seems to be mostly focused from an activism perspective on WikiLeaks.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And perhaps this is the more clear way in which we could talk about there being something positive or proactive or interesting happening. Mm-hmm. Because, right, was not... some of the political actions that have happened in the last year a result of some of the information exposed by WikiLeaks. In other words, it's one thing for you to see my gaming credentials on my PlayStation.
Mm-hmm.
It's something else entirely to see what the U.S. government is up to.
Yeah, so, I mean, as if I look at Anonymous, I think they're mainly about free speech anyway, so
yeah.
WikiLeaks is a clear focal point for that. And if you look at all the targets, I mean, also with the entire Arab world, I mean, they're mainly about free speech, which is for anyone. I'm guessing that's what at least the masses there go for. Which is an easy target, because who doesn't like free speech, right?
China.
Yeah. Quite some parts within the US.
Yeah.
Like, yeah.
But within the Western world, which apparently it seems to attract, I guess, the members of Anonymous.
Yeah, I'm sure it's mostly the Western world, yeah. And the only people who have high-speed internet connection to home.
Exactly.
There's nearly no Anonymous from Asia,
yeah,
for example. Like, it's very stupid, there's language-specific Anonymous channels.
Oh, really?
Yeah, but there's no Asian ones.
So there are all the major Western languages are represented. The
yeah.
German.
Yeah.
There's four people, the Dutch channel.
Yeah, one of which vanished into the party van. I don't think there was a Dutch channel, but never mind. But
the Dutch are the most likely to be in the English channel of
yeah,
all the other European countries. Yes,
they don't speak Dutch anymore.
But from an activist perspective, it's incredibly badly organized inside of it. It's hilarious.
And not.
Yeah.
It's
hilarious.
But it works.
Yeah, I mean, again, it doesn't. Yeah, I maybe your thoughts, because I've now been on the road for a little while, so I haven't paid attention to the drama the last 2 months. There was this person who was obviously on the inside of the organizing group who, what did he do? He locked everyone out of the IRC channels?
Yeah, there was somebody had an ops takeover of the IRC channel.
And what was the fallout of this?
You got booted, somebody reinstalled the IRC server, and that was it, essentially. And but also, because there's so little continuity within the group. Like, some people, they join the IRC server for a day, and that's it, and then they leave again. Some join it for a week, do something in that week time, leave again, etc., and then maybe come back months later. And also, within the better organized parts of it, people communicate with nicknames which are only unique hashes.
Mm-hmm.
So there's absolutely no identity anymore, which is great. So there's no continuity at all, either.
Unique hashes. How annoying. I can't imagine how annoying those channels will be.
No. the fun part is... There's some parts where people communicate through... through pirate pads, which are hosted on Tor exit nodes, which use unique hashes to communicate in real time with each other. Can you imagine how confusing that is?
Yeah.
And then try to imagine 20 geeks trying to write a manifesto together.
Yeah. No, thank you. Thank you for the offer. But no. You frankly lost me at the pirate pads at the exit nodes. Yeah. I mean, honestly, what will be interesting will be to see when the first prosecutions happen into a person in the central group, and how it happens. Because, of course, we know from radical circles, right, the ways in which these things actually get broken isn't by the front door. You know,
no,
I mean, no one's going to break half of these security measures. What instead they're going to do is they're going to
you know, do some, maybe some more aggregate ISP sort of information where they're going to look at packet flows and have some understandings of like just general locations, and then they're going to do human resources into, you know, computer labs that are for pay, computer labs at universities. You know, in other words, it's going to be the old boot leather detectives who are going to zoom in on these people, and then their moms who rat them out.
But yeah, this is also like there's a huge which is also why not so many people got arrested, I think. There's a huge safety in the mass in it, even though essentially 3/4 of all the mass can be personally identified on sure. on the IRC server, but the justice services themselves, or like hoe noem je dat in het Engels, politie, justitie, dat hele gedoe. Just essentially like the whole criminal investigations, mm-hmm. etc. They also themselves know that it makes no sense to prosecute individuals. Mm-hmm. You have to like destroy the whole organization. So yeah, the scary part is if they essentially get somebody from in a bit more in contact with the inner groups from these kind of organizations.
Yeah, again, why would they care about the group? They care about the IRC servers. I mean,
mm-hmm.
it's like way infrastructure, and you've got roots, something like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, this is, I mean, I definitely think about this a lot from the perspective of, you know, to these, I mean, maybe the best news about groups like Anon is that they're going to take all the, like, how many people are white hat hackers working for the government or working for police agencies or the rest? In other words, like, I totally enjoy the fact that they're going to spend all their time, which is going to be considerable, to in these sorts of hunts. It actually, I think, on some level, frees the political people.
Then again, still, you still have with Anon. Anon is also not just an action group, but also a concept. So even if, like, the...
Sure.
Because what we now call in the inner groups is essentially just a couple of affinity groups which exist within the mass of Anonymous, which are more technically capable. If they fall away, then the mass still exists. So you're not going to destroy this critical mass with it, because it already has a critical mass.
Although, again, maybe it is good to talk a little bit about what ways we think that once the DDoS attack is taken out of the tool belt, what other directions are these people going to go? I'm not sure that
that's
flooding Amazon's forums with, you know, bad vibes.
Because that's something I really like. Fear from a perspective like this to say, because I don't really see, like, I'm totally agree with you from an abstract point of view, the processing power in data centers, and then I'm not saying bandwidth capability, but processing power in data centers rises at a higher rate than the upstream data capacity of the civilian population.
Absolutely.
So essentially you've lost the battle already, or you'll lose it in some time in the future. It doesn't really matter when or in which term of capacity. So you lose this at some point.
A sidebar. Have any of you paid attention to the bandwidth war happening around Netflix in the US? I don't know if you have Netflix in Europe.
No, we don't. We have nothing like that in Europe.
Yeah, basically Netflix is a service that during prime time hours from East Coast to West Coast is using measurably around 25% of all bandwidth.
It's a paid TV service.
Yes, I know. It's
a
streaming movie.
We're still talking to this microphone, I think.
And, I mean, can you imagine what that, like, holy shit. I mean, this is amazing. And they basically just did kind of like this amazing deal where, you know, of course, the way in which bandwidth, the cost works is that, basically it's really bringing the conversation around net neutrality into sharp focus. And I'm going to be a little foggy in the details because it's been a few months since I really was digging into this, but it's an amazing story where they used to pay, Akamai, who were the big name in these content delivery networks, where Akamai would pay rent to all of the different network providers to have a cabinet in their provider, and so you know you essentially would only have to pay for the big trip once, and then there'd be a chunk of data here,
you know, for the most popular shows or whatever, and then from the network provider's perspective, it ends up being affordable if they're getting the money from Akamai, right? So that, I'm obviously talking to the microphone, but essentially Netflix, but with all that said, Akamai pays out a lot of money because they are the most expensive of all the CDN providers. So Netflix mm-hmm. went to some combination of using Comcast, who essentially are one of the tier one providers, mm-hmm. and some sort of fudgy work, and so it's essentially like they're trying to pay Comcast to act like a CDN, where Comcast is actually having to be like a tier one provider more often because of how the network graph works. And so as a result, Netflix was like an incredible deal for them. But this is basically bringing Comcast into sharp focus of wanting to end net neutrality. Mm-hmm. So it's a really fascinating story that basically the whole thing, of course, ends up to be about money. Shocking. Rather than any sort of technical details at all. But the technical details are really fascinating because imagine having a service like this and what it would require to run it in an affordable fashion. Really interesting.
What I find a rather depressing insight in that is that by now a quarter of the internet is TV.
Yeah.
This
does speak to my ambivalence about video myself, yes.
Then again, another quarter of the internet is probably porn.
Hmm? More than a quarter, probably.
Whatever, but I mean, most significant digits.
Most of the internet is always useless.
At least anonymously accessible porn was something new and innovative.
What's fascinating is how fast, actually, CDN traffic shot up past torrent traffic, downloadable MP3s. In other words, all the terror scenarios from the content provider's perspectives,
yeah.
Where they were just, you know, torrents are going to destroy us. Especially from the bandwidth perspective, and there was all this discussion about throttling traffic and all the rest, irrelevant when Netflix came in the world. Which, by the way, Amazon has a competing service, as does something called Hulu, which is basically an aggregate of some of the big network providers like Fox and a couple others.
But for those implicates that if we're talking figures like this and companies like this, means that we really lost the war when it comes to really important subjects regarding it. Yeah.
So. Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, we're definitely walking among the things of giants.
Yeah.
But you know, we have toenail clippers.
But traffic-wise, mainly because.
Yeah.
No, but if they are able to define politics on such a level, it has huge implications for our work as well, of course.
Of course. Absolutely.
Then of course there are people who say, "Well, fuck the net." You know, let's build our own nets.
But then you don't reach anybody anymore.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you know, the only argument that I would make for, you know, good old American capitalism is that, by and large, these corporations don't give a fucking rat's ass what's happening underneath their feet. In other words, their battles are with each other.
Yeah.
And they're mostly the implications of the sorts of laws that they buy into place. Affect us by not on purpose, but because, you know, again,
it's a byproduct
of other,
but it still can be harmful to us.
Absolutely.
Well, anyway, the size these companies have managed to grow into is a political force in itself. Look at what Google did to Ireland.
Mm-hmm. Oh, tell me about this. I don't know if that's interesting.
Well, Ireland was going to push through a lot of tax reforms, and the initial idea was to take the money from the companies. Google is primarily located in Ireland because of its nice, easy taxing.
It's financially headquartered there, so it summarizes its profits in Ireland.
Google said, if you do this, we leave Ireland. Hence, in the end, you lose. It didn't get through.
Wow, interesting.
It's very direct.
Yeah, wow.
It's pretty scary to have one company with such an insane amount of economic power that it effectively...
Yeah, I mean, of course, you know, where I live is at the heart of most of these battles mm-hmm. in this regard.
but we don't necessarily see these parts of it. It's very mm-hmm. interesting. Because, you know, really the one of the main data centers, actually one of my servers lives, 10U from one of Facebook's data centers.
Mm-hmm.
And another one lives a couple hundred yards from what's called May West. Do you know what May West is?
Yeah.
It's May West. Basically, back in the day when the internet was finite,
mm-hmm.
There were basically two places that you would point to as being the heart of the internet.
Mm-hmm.
May yeah. East, which is in Manhattan, right. and May West, which is in San Jose. And, yeah, so basically mm-hmm. it's like, the pipes are very big.
We're bringing in memes now.
Yeah. The tubes are very big. Yeah, yeah, there you go.
I need more Kool-Aid.
Yeah, I was actually going to say the... maybe the next step for Anonymous is becoming backhoe operators.
What operators?
Backhoe operators. They have a claw on the back. They're construction equipment with a big claw on the end.
Mm-hmm.
Like, okay. there was an outage that happened at a data center that I actually lived at. And so this is the nature of the Bay Area, is that sorry. So I think the only really major site that was impacted by this was, I'll think of it later, but basically a big chunk of kind of some of the brand new, at that time, the Web 2.0 companies
yeah.
was impacted because a construction operator was digging a trowel for some water
yeah.
and went through some shiny blue cables and boom, down goes the data center. Yeah, it was pretty amazing and definitely like one of those reassuring signs that the internet is everywhere.
But yeah, there's also this infamous deep sea line which got cut last year
in the Mediterranean.
Yeah, also, yeah. Great story. Yeah, no coincidences there.
Yeah. Well, yeah, there are only a few going to some of the North African countries.
Yeah, and it got cut like twice or something, even. I don't remember the exact story, but yeah. I read it's kind of, yeah. Gibson was there again.
Yeah, absolutely.
But there are four or five companies busy now with the African fiber from Spain, from France, all the way to South Africa, actually, which Western Africa is now the last part of the world which is not connected to fiber as yet. So there are four or five companies competing now to get on land.
They're finally bringing them the light. Huh? They're finally bringing them the light.
Yeah.
It's definitely clearly popular there now. So.
Yeah. Well, most countries, because the fiber hasn't reached land as yet, Ghana is one of the first countries which has been hit already. Or,
yeah. What's interesting is I saw an article about this that basically said what this is actually impacting right away are the cell phones, not the
mm-hmm.
not what we would call the we're not seeing computer labs grow out of it. We're seeing cell phone connections.
Well, yeah. Well, of course, the internet is quite popular as well in Western Africa. But most ISP are now using satellite connections, which is hideously expensive. Of course, still well. It's manageable, it's sort of affordable for semi-large companies. Well, and you see now that some foreign investors from China, of course, are trying to get ahead of this and already install infrastructure in Western African countries in anticipation of the arrival of the landlines.
Yeah, see, that'll be very interesting because you wonder how many of these countries are really ready for an internet economy.
Yep.
You know, I mean, literacy rates are in the 20s. You know, I mean, it's really going to be very interesting. I mean, China's very smart, but they're thinking generations ahead. They're not thinking years ahead. I mean, China's already really heavily invested in Central and South Africa,
mm-hmm.
like much more so than the West is.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. Well, of course,
for resources.
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah. Oil first, I guess, maybe Web 4.0 or 5.0 later.
Yeah. fourth wave society, like the transhumanists call it.
Have you all seen the movie Sleep Dealers?
No.
Strongly recommend it. I would even call it the best science fiction movie in the last 20 years.
Sleep Dealers?
Sleep Dealers.
Sleep Dealers.
It's a cyberpunk movie set in Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
And it's beautiful cyberpunk. And by and large, right, most science fiction movies aren't really science fiction.
No.
And usually aren't movies, but you know, that's another. By loose interpretation of movies, they're movies. But this is actually science fiction, like true science fiction, and it's set in a third world country, which makes the cyberpunk piece of it actually really poignant. And yeah, it's a very nice movie. It's strongly recommended.
Maybe some kind of
probably.
Maybe we can stream it.
Well, maybe you could tell a little bit more about this movie. Or?
Yeah, essentially the concept of it is that at some point the borders become as militarized as everyone who we know is interested in militarizing the border finally makes them. So, of course, in the U.S., our militarization of borders looks a little different, because we don't have these huge camps that you have here, where it's much more complicated to send people back. For us, it's much simpler, of course, because you're generally just sending them back over one line.
Yeah, you only have one border anyway, so... Yeah.
Primarily, right? We don't mind if the Canadians sneak in.
Like if they want to.
And the terrifying thing for me, personally, maybe it's just some sort of strange phobia I have, is that they just implemented... a brand new surveillance technique on the southern border, which is that they're flying drones now. And I have to say, for me, this is the most triggering thing I can possibly imagine.
Yeah, it's a bit Skynet, but they're actually starting to do this in Europe now as well. There's now... what?
In the water?
In Europe.
Water?
Well, there's several routes where illegal immigrants move into Europe to get to all the different countries they want to get exile in.
Just to
geographically... Well, the one from Turkey to Greece, for example, and you have a couple of islands and specific lanes at the sea from Northern Africa to Italy and to Spain. And there's the border between Poland and Russia, because there's also lots of illegal immigrants coming over the Russian way, although even though they're coming from, say, Afghanistan. And there's now a European Union project called Frontex, which works on essentially preventing this. And they're nearly paramilitary. They're armed like riot police squads, but they also use drones. They also use... RA-8 Reaper drones to patrol borders.
Yeah, to me this is absolutely terrifying.
Yeah, it's like literally it's like Skynet-ish. Yeah.
And because the next step is in the U.S., and I just predict this is going to happen in the next 2 to 5 years, maybe probably two, is that they're going to take down the police helicopters, which obviously are terrifying and ridiculous in and of themselves. Do you have any of those in Europe? Where the actual local police departments go up in helicopters and shine lights on people running away?
Not shining lights, it's for observation.
They're used every now and then. Also against squatters, of course.
In the U.S. it's primarily like to fight crime, you know, as it's happening.
Yeah.
And so, or O.J. Simpson as he's running away, you know. But what they'll do is they'll bring them down. They'll retire the officers who fly them, who are, of course, very highly paid, and the crews that maintain these things, which are also, you know, very expensive operations, something like $10,000 an hour.
Helicopters are incredibly expensive.
Yeah, very, very expensive. And they'll pop up 4 drones.
Yeah.
That'll cover the towns all the time. They'll never need to come down, right?
Yeah, these drones are actually exist in prototype stage already.
Yeah,
like
there's one that's been deployed during eviction.
What I meant, like, the drones, which, like, they're solar-powered, and they literally can stay up for, like, 150 days without maintenance or anything.
Yeah, exactly.
And it becomes perfectly feasible to have, like, a complete, like, visualized map of, like, what everything moves on this strip of land.
Yeah. And you've probably seen the some of the stories of these U.S. soldiers who basically... They live in Las Vegas, in the suburbs of Las Vegas. They commute
they wake up at 8 o'clock in the morning, they drive into their office job that basically involves grabbing onto a joystick.
Yeah.
And the only reason they need pilots at all, quote-unquote pilots at all, in Afghanistan or other theaters of operation is to get the drones up into the air when you need a little faster response time.
Mm.
And then they just pass the control of the drone to Las Vegas, and these essentially office workers who live on joysticks.
From an economics perspective. That's the next scary step. Like, most drones now are only reconnaissance units. Like, armed drones are still not fully used as operational units in the American Army and Air Force. But that's also not happening. And, like, there's, like, this principle of, like, hurting somebody is psychologically more easy if there's more distance between it. And now there's literally, like, a complete globe in distance between it. It's an absolute absurdity.
Asimov is spinning in his grave.
Who's spinning in his grave?
Asimov.
Asimov. Yeah. Yeah, Isaac Asimov.
The robotics.
It's not a robot, because it's not
on the mistakes. There was this classic example of, I believe it was South Africa a few years ago, where they had a computer-assisted anti-aircraft missile that went mad, and it started shooting around the base and killed like 8 soldiers.
What?
Like I said,
can I file the bug report?
Like I said before, Skynet. Just watch out when they start talking in an Austrian accent.
then it's
time to start digging.
Plus, he is looking for a job. So.
Yeah. Oh dear. Maybe he can do the speech font for it.
I can do the voice acting.
So back to the movie. The movie doesn't involve drones.
What else is in the movie?
Sleep dealers. So where we're at is a highly militarized border. You know, in other words, they have successfully closed them. There is no more immigration. So the only immigration that's left now is our people who jack in from third world countries, and they jack into the examples that they use is essentially like the mundane labor that's done, like construction or even your house cleaners and whatnot are essentially robots that are inactive until somebody's jacked into them, and then they become active. So there's definitely quite a few scenes of like construction robots with Mexican laborers essentially driving them, and then the reverse example is drones, American military drones, being driven by American soldiers who jacked in from the other side.
We'll make sure that the workers stay in Mexico.
Exactly, yeah. So, yeah, terrifying and very, very good. Very, so, totally topical. So, strongly recommended.
Okay.
Yeah.
More dystopian sci-fi.
Yeah.
Steve Jackson, of all people, published a book on this 10 years ago, describing exactly a society like this. Quite funny. Steve Jackson was a good guy.
Is he dead?
No, he still lives. I should work on my tenses.
Was that Chavez who said this about Chomsky?
Yeah.
You got that quote from Chavez?
I think vaguely.
Yeah, he was praising Chomsky and saying how he wished he would have met him when he was still alive.
He didn't take it a step further then. Although Chomsky's wife did die 2 years ago, so maybe it was he meant her.
Nah.
No.
Shall we shut down the mic? This is...
Yeah, well, we can also go to the fire and actually have some beers.
Yeah.
Because what time is it now?
It's 15 past 11.
Ah, yeah, that's quite a long...
At what time did we start our conversation?
9:30, I think.
Yeah.
2 hours.
But does anybody have some interesting topic to philosophize about?
Yeah.
The upcoming revolution.
And we're done.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. No, thank you.